information. So, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've distributed some information to you today about the meeting that you have scheduled on Thursday, which is a visit to Portland Community College. You'll find in all, you have a number of materials here, most of them Department of Education responses to your previous questions. But you should see a set of items that includes a legal-sized sheet attached to it. At the top of this will be instructions either for making the shuttle or for driving. So whichever one you see there is what we think that you're planning to do. So if you see instructions for the shuttle and you're planning to drive, please let us know, or vice versa. Briefly, if you are planning to take the shuttle, we plan to leave at about 3:05, so please meet down in the Capitol parking garage, either by the House or Senate elevators, and we'll pick you up and take you to PCC on Thursday. If you're planning to drive, there are driving instructions attached in lieu of the instructions about the shuttle. All of this information, by the way, was also emailed to you, so if you need electronic versions of any of this, it will be in your inbox. Attached to this is an agenda for the meeting at the back. Please note that the meeting starts at 4 o'clock with a tour of PCC Sylvania campus facilities and then continues with an informational meeting until 7 p.m. The title or the topics of the meetings are community colleges, community college K-12 partnerships, and other education issues. Please let me know if you have any questions about the meeting on Thursday. An additional piece of scheduling information for you is that this Thursday meeting will actually be the next meeting of the subcommittee, because the meeting that was scheduled for tomorrow needs to be canceled. There will not be a subcommittee meeting tomorrow. We had some issues getting people who were hoping to get to be able to testify to you tomorrow. So we'll skip tomorrow. On Thursday, we'll go here to Portland Community College, and then beginning the next Monday, we'll get back to State School Fund testimony here in the Capitol.
Thank you very much. So that means that the three of us will not be here tomorrow, but everyone else probably will show up, and we will have the last laugh.
Right.
It's kind of like going to class, and they announce that the midterm has been held off for a week. So, and I want to make it perfectly clear that it says in the directions to go to PCC Sylvania, it says turn right on K Street. It's not the K Street that exists in Washington, D.C., where all the lobbyists are. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's not the same. It's good. And I just found out from that tomorrow's meeting was canceled, so I wanted you to know that. Unless there are any questions or comments, I think we should proceed. Are we going to go straight to Mr. Wigger?
Mr. Chair,
say a couple things?
I might real quick, just sure, to let you know what's in front of you, because there's a rather large stack of paper. The first piece of it is the policy packages for both the department and for the school fund and school and school improvement fund. The policy packages with the performance measures that are attached to those. And then on top of that are some sheets that Brian wanted to have passed out that he was answering some of the questions that he had received yesterday. So that's what this stack of paper is.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Is this inclusive of local and state, excluding federal?
Mr. Reeder, I don't know if you heard that question. Are we talking about the
public school current expenditures per student, the data that you provided? To show our national standard.
Chair Belizio, Senator Morris, current expenditures is a term that the federal government uses. We tend to use the term operating expenditures in Oregon. Both of those include spending of state, local, and federal money.
Okay, so all funds.
Yes.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Reeder. And thank you for being here again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Belizio, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Brian Reeder, Oregon Department of Education. Just briefly, the three handouts I provided today were in response to questions asked yesterday, and I'll just go through those very quickly. The first one was the one referenced by Senator Morse, which shows a history of per-student current expenditures for Oregon and also the national average as reported by the U.S. Census Bureau, really the only source of cross-state comparisons of this type of data is the data put out by the Census Bureau in cooperation with the U.S. Department of Education. The question asked yesterday by Senator Morse was, where would Oregon be in the national rankings if the QEM were fully funded? The national data, the latest available right now, is for the 03-04 school year, so I present a history back to 1991-92, both for Oregon and for the national average, and then for 03-04, adjust Oregon's amount by the estimated degree that the QEM exceeds current funding levels. And the QEM currently represents roughly a 21% increase in funding relative to where we actually are in Oregon. So what I did was simply increase that 03-04 amount of 76-19 by 21% to arrive at the 92-34 estimate. And had Oregon been at that level in 03-04, we would have ranked 14th in the country, 14th highest, and that would have put us about 11.4% above the national average. If you look back in history, back to the early 90s, we were ranked anywhere from 14th to 18th in those years nationally. So the fully funding the QEM would put us back roughly to where we were in the early 90s in terms of our rank, although if you look at the percent of the national average, it would put us at a higher level than we were in any of those years. The highest percent of the national average we reached was 108% in 1992-93. The second handout shows the number of staff by the categories that I presented the salary data for yesterday, and that this is in response, I believe, to a request by Representative Jensen to see the number of staff in those categories. These are on an FTE basis. What we find is that we have quite a few school staff who are part-time. And sort of a bit surprising to me is we have a lot of superintendents who are part-time, which is why we have fewer superintendent FTE than we have school districts in Oregon. We have some half-time superintendents in some of our smaller districts, and we have a number of elementary-only districts that don't have superintendents at all. So that's why you see fewer than the 198 superintendents in Oregon. And the final table shows, at the request of Representative Barnhart, a history of the starting salaries of master's degree teachers back to 1991. And keep in mind that these are an average of actual teachers who are first-year teachers with a master's degree in each of these years. The percent change from year to year is a bit erratic, and I believe that is because in some years you'll have more of these teachers in higher-paid districts and fewer in lower-paid. In other years, it'll be vice versa. So these are, in essence, a weighted average of the first-year salaries that individual districts pay, and then they are weighted by the number of teachers in those categories in those districts. So what it shows overall, an annual average increase of 2.5%, which is a bit below the annual average increase for all teachers that I presented yesterday, which was 2.8% over the same period. So a little bit below the overall changes. With that, I will launch into the state school fund formula. Just a bit of a recap from yesterday. Most of the money, most of the revenue that school districts in Oregon receive, operating revenue, does come through the formula. The current formula was adopted by the 1991 legislature. It hasn't changed really significantly since that time. In the early years, the mid to late 90s was a phase-in period for the formula where districts that were highly funded were held harmless, while the rest of the districts, the lower funded districts in Oregon, caught up with them. So the formula did have some hold harmless provisions in it for a number of years. Those provisions were pretty much fully phased in by the mid to late 90s, so that today every district is treated essentially the same. The formula distributes most of the money, about 95% of the money, on a per student basis, actually on a per weighted student basis, where higher cost students are weighted more heavily than lower cost students. And I'll talk a little bit about how we define higher cost in a moment. Really the primary objective of the formula is to, as it distributes money to districts, is to compensate districts for the degree to which their costs vary. Typically, those cost variations are based on the characteristics of the students the districts are serving, but there are a couple of provisions in the formula that are take into account characteristics of the districts themselves rather than the students, and we'll talk about those a little bit as well. The formula distributes most local revenue, most state revenue, and some federal revenue. And just for clarification purposes, the formula uses the term local revenue a little bit differently than we would in common conversation. The formula really puts money into two buckets. The first bucket is the state school fund, and the second bucket is what's referred to as local revenue. And what's in that local revenue bucket is made up of local property taxes, it's made up of state timber money, it's made up of federal timber money. So even though the formula calls it local revenue, the source of some of that money is from the federal government, some of it from state government, but the bulk of it is from local property taxes. About 80% of all district operating revenue comes through the formula, and we commonly refer to that as formula revenue. And of that 80%, nearly all of it, 95% of it, is distributed on a per weighted student basis, and the remaining 5% is distributed as grants that are not related to student counts in the district: transportation grants, high cost disability grants, and facility grants. And if you need more clarification on those grants, I'm happy to provide that. Of the total amount of revenue that the formula distributes, 95.25% goes to school districts, and the remaining 4.75% goes to ESA.
your second bullet, 80% comes through the 80% of the money comes through the formula. Where's the other 20 come from?
Chair Galizio, Representative Jensen, the remaining 20% is made up of federal grants. Those both that are direct to school districts and those that flow through the Department of Education, two school districts. Private donations to school districts don't go through the formula. Local options.
That's right. Okay. Thank you.
So one of the purposes, or a key purpose of the formula, is to get more money to higher cost districts. And the formula does that in a number of ways. The primary way is to provide weights to students based on student characteristics, and I term those student weights. But there are four other ways that money is given to districts based on their cost structures. The first is high cost disability grants. Those are grants based on special ed students that are very high cost to serve, students for whom districts spend more than $30,000. The amount above $30,000 is reimbursed to districts. Transportation costs are reimbursed to districts either at 70%, 80%, or 90%, depending on the level of the transportation costs in the individual district. The small school correction gives additional money to districts that have very small schools. The logic there is that very small schools, and actually the schools also are required to be remote, so remote small schools. The logic there being that running small schools is far more expensive on a per student basis than running larger schools. There's an adjustment in the formula based on the average years of experience of the teachers in a district relative to the statewide average. Gives additional money to districts that have above average teacher experience. And then the facility grant are relatively small grants given to districts who put in place or remodel existing facilities to create additional classroom space. And the purpose of the facility grant is to help districts purchase furnishings for new classroom space, things like desks, lab equipment, computers, and so forth. Those items under the provisions of, I believe, Measure 50, either Measure 50 or Measure 5, can no longer be purchased with bond proceeds, and so this grant is intended to help districts pay for those items that go along with adding new space but can't be bonded. Talk a little more about each of those categories, in particular student weights. And there are eight categories of student weights that the formula uses, as shown on the slide. The first category, which is termed regular, is simply a full weight for every student in the state. And this is based on what we call average daily membership. It's the average number of students enrolled in a district during the school year. And in the 06-07 school year, we have about 535,000 ADM in Oregon. Each special education student receives an additional full weight. There is a cap on that, however, up to 11% of the total ADM in a district can receive special education, the additional special education weight. English as a second language weight is an extra half weight for each student served by an ESL program. Students who are either pregnant or who have children receive an additional weight if they are served by a pregnant and parenting program by the school district. Students in poverty receive an additional quarter weight, and in this case the share of students considered in poverty is based either on census data or on the share of students eligible for free and reduced lunches under the federal free and reduced lunch program. So it's not a it's not attributed to individual students. It's a district-wide measure. And then two programs, the neglected and delinquent and the students in foster homes. Those students are identified by the Department of Human Services. The department receives counts of those students for each school district. Again, we don't have information on individual students, simply total counts for each district. And then I've listed the small school correction here as well. It's not based on student characteristics, but it does enter the formula as additional weights, additional student weights. So it increases the ADMW of a school district, and it varies by the size of the schools in those districts. Smaller schools get proportionally more small school correction weights.
Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen.
Just a quick question. The special ed has a cap of 11%. None of the other weights have caps. Is that correct?
Chair Galizio, Representative Jensen, that is correct. It's the only cap that we have. I should mention that there's also a process to grant waivers to districts, additional special ed weights above that cap. And we typically grant 3,000 to 4,000 of those waivers each year.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stark?
I was going to make the point that Mr. Reeder made, his secondary point, that there is a waiver process.
And 13%. Proposal to move it to 13% is...
There's a policy, there's a bill.
Chair Galizio, Senate Bill 211 proposed to increase the cap to, I believe, 12.5%, but amendments, I believe, have removed that provision.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reed, we actually passed the bill, and we kept the cap at 11% when we passed the bill out of committee, thinking that the waiver process was one that was still working, even though a significant number of the school districts are at the 11% cap. But we thought that waiver process and the accountability that's required was a good one for school districts.
Thank you.
Okay, once all the weights are determined for each district, then we can calculate what we call average daily membership weighted, or more commonly ADMW. And the way we do that is simply take ADMR, which in this prior slide is what we call the regular weight, and we add to it all the additional weights to get, for the current school year, the ADMW for each school district. We then compare that to the ADMW for each district in the prior year, and they get funded in the formula for the greater of those two. And the purpose of that look back is to give additional resources to declining enrollment districts, based on the notion that as their enrollment declines, they have certain fixed costs that don't decline at the same rate, and therefore they are funded at a slightly higher level than growing districts are. Beyond the weighting, the student weighting procedures that we use, there are also a number of grants and one adjustment that provide additional resources to districts with higher costs. The first is the high cost disability grant that I mentioned. Provides a reimbursement to districts who spend greater than $30,000 on individual students on IEPs, special education students. Transportation grants reimburse districts up to 90% of their eligible transportation expenditures. Eligible expenditures are those that are home to school and school to home, and also trips for educational purposes, for example, field trips. It does not include trips for athletic events or other non-educational type transportation costs of school districts. Districts who are in the 90th percentile or above in terms of their transportation spending per student are reimbursed at the 90% rate, those between the 80th and 90th percentile are at 80%, and everybody else is at 70%. So it's a reimbursement program rather than a matching program, or it's a direct reimbursement that varies as expenditures vary. Going a little bit out of order here, the facilities grant, as I described, provides additional resources to districts who have put in place new classrooms, either through new construction or remodeling space. It's relatively small. It distributes, I believe, it was just raised to $25 million a biennium, split between the 2 years. It provides a grant up to 8% of the amount the district spent their capital spending to put in place the new classroom space, and if funds aren't sufficient to provide the full 8% grant, then they're prorated. We end up prorating them almost every year because the amount of money available isn't sufficient to provide 8% grants to every district. The grants typically run in the 3-4% range. And then finally, the teacher experience adjustment. The way that works is for each year of teacher experience that districts exceed the statewide average, they receive an additional $25 per weighted student through the formula. So above average experienced districts get more money, below average get less money. In a typical year, those two amounts pretty closely balance out.
Representative Jensen?
Just a curiosity point on this. Do you have data that will measure the difference between the amount of experience and the performance of the school?
Sure, there you go, Representative Jensen. We do have that data. In fact, the procedure that I mentioned yesterday that we use to evaluate performance and spending, those models also include teacher experience variables to try and understand whether teacher experience has an impact on student performance, and the equations that we've estimated here, both at the school level and the district level, seem to indicate that higher experienced teachers do have an impact on student learning. They do lead to improved student performance, as measured by our standardized test scores.
Can you share some of that data with us, if I could, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me.
No.
Representative Blizzo, Representative Jensen, yeah, we can. It's interpreting the results of those models takes a bit of effort, but I'm happy to provide that for you.
Okay.
So the formula calculation itself, I've simplified this a bit because all the math can get really messy. It's not terribly complicated, but there's lots of parts to it. So in general, though, what we call the general purpose grant of a school district is simply their number of weighted students, ADMW, times a dollar amount. And unfortunately, the dollar amount you see here is incorrect. and that's my error. I inadvertently used the number that has the transportation funding in it. That number, instead of 5861, should say 5630. And that's a number from the current school year, the 06-07 school year. And once that general purpose grant is calculated, then we add in the transportation grant, the high-cost disability grant, and the facility grant to get the total amount that the school district receives through the formula. And then the state distributes that portion that the school district doesn't already have in its hands, and the portion they already have in their hands is their local property taxes and the federal money that comes directly to them, for example, federal forest fees. So, for example, if the school district were entitled to $10 million through the formula and $3 million of it they collected locally, the state would send them the remaining $7 million. If another district were entitled to $10 million and they collected $8 million locally, then the state would send them $2 million. So even though the formula distributes all the money, the districts already have part of it already, and we simply send them the difference.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Starr.
Is there a schedule that money is released to the school districts, and can you talk a little bit about how that's distributed?
Yes, Chair Glees, Senator Starr, there is a schedule. The state makes 11 payments during each school year, starting in July. The July, and each payment, with the exception of the July payment, is 1/12 of the total that the school district is to receive during the year. The July payment is a double payment, so it is 2/12 of the total. So we pay them July through May, and we don't make a payment in June. Now, as we start the school year, we don't know exactly how much they're going to get, because all of the data on which their payments are based is not in yet. So we make estimates at the beginning of the school year, pay them up through April based on those estimates, and then in May, once we have more data, we make an adjusting payment to sort of reconcile to their annual total.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. That payment you make based on your example of, it's based on what the local money stays with them. That's not part of the payment that they get.
Correct.
So they get that in a lump sum, or they get that to basically the base, and then whatever the state supplements for the state school fund formula, that portion is divided into the 11 payments.
Chair Glees, Senator Starr, that's correct. They receive the bulk of their property tax, I believe, in a fairly large lump sum. The money from other sources, such as the Common School Fund, comes in two annual payments to them. The federal forest fees, I believe, come in quarterly payments. So it's a mix of different payment streams. But you're correct. The monthly payments from the state are just the state school fund amounts.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
ESDs have their own formula, which works slightly different than the district formula. It's actually based on the district formula, but it's much simpler. ESDs receive 4.75% of the total money that goes out through the formula. And the way that works is we determine how much the constituent districts of each ESD receive, and then the ESD distribution is based on that amount. It's simply their districts receive a certain amount, and then they receive 4.75% of the total based on their constituent districts. That in 06-07 is expected to be about just under $300 per weighted student. And there is a provision in the law that for ESDs whose formula revenue is under $950,000, that they will be brought up to that floor of $950,000. There are 5 ESDs in the state that are subject to that floor. And they receive anywhere from $400,000 to $600,000 through the general formula, and then are brought up to the $950,000 floor to compensate for that. Uh, Did want to talk a little bit about local option property taxes. They are outside the formula, but do represent an important source of revenue for a number of school districts. Local option property taxes are operating levies. They are sometimes confused with local bond levies. They are a different type of levy than local bond levies, and they're intended to be used for operating purposes. They have to be approved by voters like bond levies do. They don't flow through the formula, as I mentioned. They are subject to the Measure 5 limits, another difference from bond levies, which are not subject to the Measure 5 limits. And they also, for some districts, qualify for a matching grant from the state, what we call local option equalization grants. I believe I have some additional information about those grants. Districts that have low assessed value per student, if their assessed value per student is below the 75th percentile, then they qualify for a matching grant from the state. And that grant phases out as for districts who are close to the 75th percentile. So larger grants, the lower your assessed value per student. That program has been in place since the 2001-03 biennium. In that biennium, there was an appropriation of $400,000. Two districts qualified for grants. And the combined value of those grants was fairly close to the $400,000 amount that was appropriated. In 2003-05, an additional district qualified, but the appropriation again was $400,000. That third district's grant was quite small, so really no additional appropriation was needed. One of the difficulties with trying to estimate the amount needed for these grants is that because of the provisions of the Measure 5 limits, it's very hard to know how much a given tax rate will raise for a local option levy. And because these grants are based on the size of those levies, it's also hard to know how much the grants will be. So we're in some sense making a guess at some of these in advance, which is why the appropriation often doesn't match exactly the amount that we give out in grants. And what we tend to do was estimate a tad high so that we have sufficient resources to fully fund the grants. In 2005-07, $1.2 million was appropriated because an additional district, Hood River, passed a local option and qualified for a very large equalization grant, close to $400,000 themselves, for both years of the biennium. And then in 2007-09, currently in House Bill 5020, there is a $400,000 appropriation for local option equalization grants. We expect five districts to qualify for grants during the biennium, and will qualify for grants again on the order of $1.1 to $1.2 million. So at this point, the appropriation of $400,000 will lead to proration of those grants. It's not sufficient to cover the full amounts of the grants that we're expecting. And at this point, that's all I have for the formula, and can talk a little bit about the policy option packages that are related to the state school fund. These are the policy option packages as presented in the governor's budgeting process, and so they look a little bit different than they might under the co-chair's budget. The dollar look a little bit different here. The policy option package for the state school fund itself is $193.9 million. That's the governor's proposed state school fund of $6 billion. It's the amount that $6 billion exceeds the EBL of 5.08. So the moving target EBL. And then the school improvement fund that's proposed by the, in the governor's budget is $60 million. So those two separate POPs related to the state school fund. One of the exercises that we tried to go through here is to estimate the impact on student performance of those two additional funding streams. And the way I did that was to rely again on the education production function model that we developed as part of the quality education model process. One of the outputs of that model is to estimate how student performance will be impacted at various funding levels. So that the $193.9 million above EBL represents roughly 10% of the additional funding that the Quality Education Commission proposed, 10% of the $1.96 billion that they proposed. And so applying that to the equation or the output of the production function equations gives us an estimate of what we could expect from that additional resource.
Mr. Reeder, just for clarification, it might go to you or maybe Darren. Is when the governor's recommended budget came out, we had the EBL figure. Is it accurate? There's a $17 million difference between when the governor's recommended budget was crafted versus when the co-chair's budget was crafted. Isn't it about a $17 million difference in the EBL? Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, if I might clarify, the EBL number, the expenditure side of it, has remained the same. But there are an additional $17 million in local revenues, so the state portion to fund EBL is $17 million less than it was at the governor's budget.
Thank you.
So this slide shows, and this will look familiar to you, this is the same third grade math graph that I showed you yesterday. The bold solid line is on the bottom is our forecast of the percent of students meeting or exceeding standard if current funding patterns continue. The top dashed line is the fully funded quality education model, and the unbolded line in between is our estimate of the student performance impact of the additional $193 million. It is simply a portion of the impact that we would expect to see with a fully funded quality education model. So that's how those estimates were arrived at. We can see a similar pattern for fifth grade math. For eighth grade math, a little easier to see on the eighth grade graph here because the differences are larger, and then on the 10th grade math as well. And then the second policy option package, number 455, the school improvement fund, as proposed in the governor's budget, $50 million for increasing student achievement, $10 million for implementing new high school diploma requirements.
the details of that. In Senate Bill 318, sort of lay out a menu of choices that school districts can make to use those additional resources. And rather than trying to make estimates of student performance changes from that amount, it's a relatively small amount of additional money. If we were to use the same procedure that we used for the prior one, the differences in student performance on these graphs would almost be indiscernible. But in identifying those performance measures where these additional resources may have an impact, again, student achievement, presumably the high school diploma requirements will have an impact on high school graduation rates. Also I've identified schools and districts, the number of schools and districts meeting federal adequate yearly progress standards would be impacted by these additional resources, improvement in low performing schools, and also in the highly qualified teacher provisions of NCLB potentially would be impacted too. Yes.
I don't even know if it's possible to answer this question, but might as well try. Let's say that instead of $60 million, you put in $260 million, just to come up with a number. So how many years out would it take us to really see some kind of an impact? I mean, it's got to take a while for, right, in terms of measurement?
Triglisio, you're right. That's a hard question to answer. In talking with school districts and with educators, what they tell us is that additional resources, large amounts of additional resources, all at once, they would prefer not to have that happen because they tell us that they don't have the capacity to use very large amounts of additional resources efficiently if they get them all at once. And similarly, I think it takes time to build capacity to change the way they do things in school districts. And so, by that same logic, we wouldn't expect to see dramatic student performance changes all at once. Unfortunately, the models that we have don't give us very good information about the timing of those sorts of things. Most of the models that we have built have been built on what we call cross-sectional data, which is data for a given year looked at across districts or across schools. Some of the models that we're starting to build now look at both across districts and schools and across time, all in the same model. So presumably they'll give us some more clues about the patterns in how additional resources, the timing of how additional resources affect districts' ability to utilize those resources effectively. But right now I really don't have a very good answer for you.
And $250 or $260 million, how much is that per student?
Rule of thumb.
This would be 10th grade math, at least.
Rule of thumb for the coming biennium is $100 million into the state school fund for the biennium will get you $70 per weighted student each year for districts and another $3.50 for ESDs. So close to $74 total for each $100 million.
Thank you.
And that's all I have.
Representative Barnard?
Well, just a comment on that answer. We're looking at the operating budget here. And, of course, if you decided, for example, that you wanted to limit class sizes at kindergarten, you'd have to build a bunch of new kindergartens, build as classroom spaces, and hire a bunch of teachers who you may not have available. You may have to train them first. So those are among the issues that I suspect he's referring to, of the logistical problems beyond simply spending operating dollars.
Chair Galizio, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly right. I mean, we know that a lot of districts in Oregon are bursting at the seams. They don't have any space, additional space, to do things like all-day kindergarten or smaller class sizes, and it takes time to put that space into place. It also takes money. Unfortunately, we don't have terribly good data on which districts have space available and which don't. I took a stab at it a couple of years ago. I guess I shouldn't bring it up because I can't remember the number. What I did was look at enrollment growth patterns and said if a district has had declining enrollment for 2 or 3 years in a row, then it's likely they have some available space if they were to reduce class sizes or and by the same token, if a district has been growing, I assume that they would have to acquire new space. And I believe the estimate I came up with was capital needs on the order of a couple hundred million dollars statewide to put in place. I believe this was in the context of all-day kindergarten, enough space to accommodate all-day kindergarten statewide. Not a trivial amount of money.
Senator Dubb, in terms of the school improvement fund, the discussion of that, I think it's one of the reasons why when we revised the statute for the school improvement fund in the Senate bill, why we're trying to take into consideration both the issue that that has commonly been brought up, that we don't want to fund one thing specifically and only that thing, because some school districts may actually already be doing that. But the other side was the issue that Representative Barnhart brought up, is there may be some barriers to some school districts doing some items, in the sense of you could say, I want to reduce class size in grades 1 through 3, and sometimes people get terribly creative, but if you've only got 5 classrooms already, and they're all at 32 students. Now, why I say creative is because I have seen libraries divided into 2 classrooms in schools. But if your physical facilities don't permit it, then we thought we should give a lot of latitude to individual school districts, and basically to basically make their own selection, both on the possibility of what they think is their highest need, but understanding the barriers that they might have.
Thank you, Senator. So, Mr. Regent, would it be is it unrealistic to say, okay, well, if we invest, let's say $250 million in the school improvement fund, then therefore in 2 years or even 4 years we should be able to see improvements in third grade literacy and reading, and we should be able to measure and see and measure fifth grade math, which score should be better? I mean, is that realistic?
Chair Galizio, I believe it is. These types of models that we're building have been around for 30 years or so. The state of the art has gotten much better. Our ability to sort of relate different characteristics of students and schools and teachers and resources to their impact on student performance has gotten considerably better. Our data has gotten better, and so I think these models, no model is perfect. It can't tell us, with absolute certainty what's going to happen, but they can tell us whether we see those relationships, whether more funding, more resources, or more experienced teachers, and so forth, are those correlated in a meaningful way with student performance. And I think based on the most recent research and some of the work we've done here in Oregon, the answer is yes. I mean, more resources do have an impact. The other question is, how big is it?
And as you mentioned before, how long does it take? And
how long does it take?
It sort of takes time. So I don't know who is Senator Becker, and then Senator Devlin, and then Representative Edwards.
I would think, and either Mr. Chair or Mr. Reeder, that the School Improvement Fund actually lends itself really well to performance measures, because whether it's teacher mentoring, which you could just, there should be a correlation between a couple years of investment in some districts and teacher mentoring should garner better retention of teachers in their early years. That would be obviously the hope of putting some money there. If it's full-day kindergarten, hopefully that manifests itself in better reading numbers in those early years. And so, to me, the School Improvement Fund is designed very well for good performance measures, which I think will be up to this committee to put the performance measures in that correlate well, and certainly any department input would be helpful. But that is my thought. I could be wrong, but in terms of this interim committee, I think that was the thought of the interim committee, that it lends itself very well to performance measures.
Senator Dunn?
One of the things that I think is confusing about the whole issue of performance budgeting, and when you've been around this for too long, and you start to actually understand some of it, and sometimes I don't think even the people that promote it understand what the... Well, I shouldn't say it that way.
No, it was getting really interesting.
Keep going. Name names.
Yeah. We've gone through this terminology. You have high-level outcomes, which are the things that are in the benchmarks. And then you have key performance measures that relate to those high-level outcomes. There is a connection between the two, but you don't expect by doing... you don't expect that automatically by having lower class sizes in first through third grade that you're automatically going to have higher graduation rates. Now, theoretically, you could, but you might have better performance in third grade reading tests and third grade math tests. So it's really, when we're talking about performance measures in the School Improvement Fund, we should be talking about key performance measures that are geared specifically on evidence-based to the item that's being funded, not to the high-level outcomes, because those are like if you see an improvement in that in a much longer period of time, you'd be doing a good job.
Thank you. I think Dr. Burke, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your record. I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department. I think this is a very important conversation, and I think it needs to be approached carefully. The issue is complex. First of all, what's the timing that the district would receive the revenue? So there are issues, for example, in the mentoring bill, which your committee has just been talking about, when those funds would actually flow. The current version of the bill, they don't flow until the second half of the biennium. So it's hard to say that within 1 year, while teachers are being mentored, that you would also see at the end of the two-year biennium increases in student achievement. And I would not want to overpromise, and I think we need to be very realistic about those performance measures. Likewise, when you approach, you are looking at choices that districts would make. Out of 198 school districts, you're going to see a variety of combinations of choices that districts would make. So, for example, the lowering of class size or offering all-day kindergarten might be a choice available to some districts and not to others, so you wouldn't necessarily see uniform response across the state on those performance measures. The third is, when do we measure? So the first kind of formal measure for all students in the state is third grade reading and third grade math. So even someone that were a district that offered all-day kindergarten, for example, or teacher professional development,
for early childhood education, we might not see the statewide impact of those types of choices until those students hit third grade. We do have some measures of kindergarten readiness, as we've explained to the committee. Those measures don't apply to all children. They are a sampling of children entering school in kindergarten. So we will have measures, and as we've said many times, we want to keep working with the committee on the performance measures. But I think we need to be realistic about what kind of data we would actually have within a two-year period of time.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. I think Representative Edwards, and then Representative Barnhart, and then Senator Stuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask a follow-up question to a comment Mr. Vitter made earlier. I'm curious about the sensitivity of the education production model to dollars as an input versus other potential factors that you've mentioned. The other factors you've noted so far include items like student characteristics, class size, course offerings, teacher qualifications, etc. So I just want to make sure that we're focused on the right levers to produce the desired outcomes. If, for instance, student characteristics is the dominant factor, hypothetically speaking, then maybe our effort would be better, our time would be better spent figuring out how to encourage educational enrichment at home, or provide or better coordinate social welfare programs to ensure students come to school ready to learn, etc., as opposed to simply putting more money into the current educational system. Can you provide some insight into the relative weights of the factors that go into the model?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, I don't carry numbers in my head typically, but you're correct.
Yes, you do. You're incredible.
I don't carry all the numbers in my head. One thing that the research is very clear on is that student characteristics have a big impact on their achievement in school, and that what happens in school is only a piece of the puzzle and may not even be the biggest piece of the puzzle. And so Representative Edwards is correct. To the extent that you can influence those things that in turn influence student performance or student achievement, then you would want to put your efforts where the biggest payoff is. Some things we simply aren't able to change. The ethnicity of students is hard to change. Sometimes their home life is hard to have an impact on. So you need to pick your policy levers carefully. You have to put your resources where you can have the most impact, and some things we can change, some things we can't.
Good follow-up?
Yeah.
I would, for the record, appreciate it if you could provide the committee with some simple chart that would indicate the relative value or explanatory power of each of the factors that goes into the education production model. As we're looking at the budget holistically, it would be worthwhile for us to better understand which areas might produce the greatest return on our collective investment.
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be really useful.
Thank you.
I think Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've been talking about the time it takes for things to have an impact on education outcomes, and one of my experiences I think might be illustrative here in a series of them. I've been following the issue pretty intensely since 1993, when events took place in my life and my then school-age son's life that brought my attention to paying attention to public school policy and to quality of the public school system. I was amazed and astounded at how well the statistical information that we had available for the Eugene School District held up for a long time after the funding cuts that substantially reduced the quality of the education that students were getting in those schools and the quality of support they were getting from counselors, from a whole, from librarians, from a variety of other things like physical education classes and music and so on. It finally did catch up, and the quality difference is obvious today as compared to what it was in 1993. But it took a number of years before those differences became obvious. And I think the most obvious thing to say is that a new student starting in 1993 who lived through those cuts did not graduate until 2005. A student who was in the fifth or sixth grade in 1993 was halfway through the process and had gotten the benefit of the good education that had been available in the Eugene school system before that time. And so it was much more difficult to impact, for the negative effects of budget cuts, to impact those children as they moved through middle and high school, because they were well prepared in the elementary school. And I would expect that the reverse of that is also true. It's going to take a number of years for the impact of restoring budgets and of actually replacing, adding counselors, librarians, music teachers, physical education teachers, a smaller class size, appropriate aides in classrooms, professional and technical education, and on and on and on, all the things that we've cut over the last 15 years in the formerly well-funded school districts, before we will see outcome results, except intermediate ones, that impact things like dropout rates and vocational choice and a whole variety of other things. Now, that's not to say there aren't things we can do in the meantime that won't make a difference, because I think there are. But I think the big number change is going to happen over time.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question and comment goes back to when Mr. Burke was at the dais, and it might be appropriate for him to return, but it's the question about the performance measures kind of at the global level, at the statewide level. You mentioned the menu approach with, you know, the 198 school districts and choosing to invest here rather than there, and the ability to how that impacts kind of the global performance measures statewide. But isn't it not the case that we can drill down to the local school district and see how the investments that a local school district make in a particular area generate success for that local school district, as opposed to kind of making the global numbers statewide make a difference? Isn't that the case that we will be able to determine school district by school district the improvements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes. My comments are more directed to a realistic understanding of how long it takes for a particular change to have the desired impact, very similar to what Representative Barnhart was just describing. So yes, you would see changes at the local level. Let me give you an example. One of the key performance outcomes nationally of investing in strong early childhood programs at the preschool and kindergarten level is that it has a fairly clear prediction on improving the high school dropout rate. Now, that's a long-term expectation that I would expect to see if we continue to invest in early childhood education, but you won't see that particular impact tomorrow. Because you're counting on, and what the research says is that as children get a strong start in school, their overall performance over their entire career in school is enhanced. So that's, I'm trying to be clear about what you might see by 2009 in terms of specific impacts of choices that are made off the menu. The other issue is looking at that, as you just said, at a district level versus looking at it at a state level, since districts will make different choices from the menu. So understanding that a dramatic impact on a particular category in the state, let's say fifth grade mathematics, we shouldn't expect that we would see that type of impact in this type of model. But certainly we would be, at our state agency,
looking not only at the choices that districts make, but then what evidence do we have of the impact of those choices. But it's simply a question of what would be the timing, the realistic timing of putting the thermometer in and saying, did this have the intended impact?
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand very well.
Whoops.
Yeah, don't raise it. Yeah. really, childhood education and the benefits. But in looking at the data that's presented, a strategy to address the deficiency that exists at that eighth grade level. Lacking a strategy, at least identified strategy, how we're going to address that deficiency. And focusing, are we kind of abandoning this group of students that have fallen behind? And in the context of math, math is such a building block learning experience. If you miss one of the blocks, you're just forever lost until you go back and get it. And if we're missing that, what's our strategy for these students that are outside of where we want them to be, used to be putting a lot of effort into early childhood?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, it's an excellent question. First of all, I wouldn't want any of my comments to be interpreted as that we should just forget about some kids for a period of time.
And I did not.
I don't
infer that. Please.
The production function model and the work that the QEC did clearly indicated that continuing to invest had an impact on student achievement. The comments that Mr. Reeder made today and yesterday also highlighted the fact that money alone, particularly in the upper grades, just putting more money in is not sufficient to get the level of growth that we're looking for. So we would also be looking at issues such as the level of professional development and preparation of teachers. Clearly things like class size have an impact. But then, as I have commented earlier, the alignment of the curriculum is also an important factor. So that at the high school level, and the numbers that we were looking at yesterday, providing an opportunity for schools to align their instructional program, the standards, and the assessment system all have a positive impact on increasing student achievement. So if in an abstract way, if I provided more funding for teachers at a high school level in mathematics and lowered the class size as a result, but did not attend to issues of curriculum alignment, quality of instruction, and the length of instruction over a 2 or 3 year period, so that, for example, as a result, students were not exposed to more algebra or geometry, I might spend more money, but I would not expect an increase in student achievement because the students have not received instruction in the content that we hold them accountable for. So just the act alone of putting more money or lowering the class size would not be sufficient in a production function model to explain what needs to happen for student achievement to improve. It's more than just the money, which is what is in the quality education report that you have a copy of.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
What I think we had envisioned in terms of the school improvement fund and in terms of what we could see if we looked at it very directly was presuming that it was funded at the level of, say, $260 million. It would probably take most of the first semester of the school year that's starting in September to get things put in place. And so when we came back in the legislature, basically in terms of having programs implemented on an optimistic standpoint, we would have the second semester of the coming year and the first semester of the following year before we actually were back in session here.
But I think we'd have to go with probably at least another biennium beyond that before we'd actually see any concrete results. But I think they would vary. I mean, we could take a cohort of school districts that, say, used the money for reducing class size in 1 through 3, and we might see some improvement there in some aspects. Then again, we could take another cohort of school districts that tried different programs to retain students, and we might get totally different data, because it wouldn't simply be the averages. Then we might be able to evaluate the programs themselves and how successful they had been in increasing the retention of students. So I think it depends upon what the school district selected about what type of data that you'd actually have. And I think we have at least about 6 or 7 different potentials within the school improvement fund, plus an open door if they can convince the Department of Education that something is evidence-based.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I agree with you very strongly. As you heard from Dr. Knorr earlier in our testimony, we would be looking very carefully at the comprehensive improvement plan, the continuous improvement planning process that districts engage in. We would be looking at whether the district has analyzed data relative to the choices that it might make, and are those choices appropriate to what some of the needs of the district are. But to also reinforce what you just said, if I dust off my old deputy superintendent hat when I worked in a school district, at this particular time of year, I'm hiring my teachers for next year. I'm not waiting to hear what happens with the legislature. I'm watching it very carefully. I know what is on the table, but I have to manage my district. So I've already done my enrollment forecasting. I've already looked at what schools I'm going to have operational. I know what my vacancies are. I've already asked my teachers to indicate who is retiring or transferring, who's going to be on leave for various reasons, and I am now in the process of interviewing candidates and hiring teachers. I'm also fairly into the process of looking at seniority within my contract and making decisions about movement of teachers within my district. I've also already had conversations with my board about my budget for next year, and we're preparing our budget to submit to the Tax Supervisory Commission to approve our budget so that we can start levying taxes by July. So all of that work is already underway, regardless of what happens right now. So it's a bit like turning a ship while it's underway. If I get more money, believe me, I would be very grateful to the legislature for having that, but it's going to take me a while then to look at, so what do I do with it? If I'm going to have to hire new teachers, how does that impact my collective bargaining agreement? Are those teachers available if I start to hire mid-year? Will I get the quality of teachers that are available to me? And if I'm changing curriculum, for example, new textbooks or new strategy, I have to also then build in professional development for the teachers who would be using that new curriculum. So, Senator Devlin, I really agree with what you just said. It's not, you don't just flip a switch here. As Mr. Reeder said, just popping money down is not a very good management strategy. Ramping up resources toward a target with data to inform those decisions is what good management would look like. Even if we approve additional funding, and we certainly hope that we do, it also needs to be managed well at the district level.
Thank you, Dr. Burt. Well, unless there are any other questions or comments, Mr. Reeder, I wanted to thank you very much, and Dr. Burke. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5020 and 5021, and just remind the committee of two things. Number one is we have no... Is Senator Deckard is gone?
Disappeared.
Okay, we have no... We're not meeting. This committee is not meeting tomorrow.
I just got noticed.
Okay, so I want to make sure that was clear. And if you are coming to Portland Community College, there will be flak jackets available. No, I'm not. So I look forward to as many of you as possible showing up. And we will, with that, I'm going to adjourn the committee.